I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is women's sports and identity. Last week, the WNBA season kicked off one of the most anticipated seasons in the league's history with the addition of Caitlin Clark to the Indiana Fever. Her run at the University of Iowa was much celebrated. Back-to-back appearances in the national championship game, record ratings for regular season tournament play. And for many, she was the catalyst for this incredible increased attention and interest in women's college basketball in the United States. You also saw other star players like Angel Reese, Paige Beckers, getting a lot of attention in the national media, more so than in previous years. So as Caitlin Clark makes the jump to the WNBA, there is a lot of attention on the league, and whether or not that interest and the growth in the women's college game that's been seen over the past few years will translate to the WNBA as well. But it also leads to a lot of questions in terms of how women's sports are perceived and some of the contradictions that are inherent in the way in which both the public and administrators at major universities look at and understand women's college sports. And that is the subject of a book by Michelle J. Mano entitled Denied: Women's Sports and the Contradictions of Identity. And this came out last year, and it is a wonderful profile where Michelle Mano spends a full season with an NCAA Division I women's basketball program as one of the team's managers. And she takes the reader behind the scenes of what it's like to be with an NCAA women's college basketball program and gets into a lot of the contradictions that exist, the way in which players are policed, the way their expression is policed, their activities are policed, their relationships are policed. And so you see within the program, players being monitored, banned from engaging in certain activities, punished for behavior that goes against traditional gender and sexuality norms. So within that, there are also elements of race and masculinity, femininity that really play into all of these contradictions. And it's a wonderful profile of this season, but it speaks to much broader, bigger issues in not only women's college basketball, but sports in general. So I was very pleased to have the opportunity to speak with Michelle. We did record this a little while ago. It was still during the NCAA college basketball season. So there are a couple of mentions in there of the ongoing season, or that we don't know that Caitlin Clark is now with the Indiana Fever. We didn't know that at the time. So do forgive those little things, but overall, I think the discussion is very evergreen and very relevant, and it is one that I very much enjoy, and I hope you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Michelle Mano. All right, and Michelle J. Mano joins me now. Michelle, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, Sean?
Doing very well. Very excited to talk to you about Denied: Women's Sports and the Contradictions of Identity. Now, before we get into some of the subject matter of the book, not only is it a profile of these big questions, it's also based on personal experience. So could you walk us through a little bit of your experience directly with women's basketball at the highest level of the NCAA?
Absolutely. So you're right. So this book, really, I sort of joke that I started writing this book when I was 8 and I was playing basketball for the first time. And I always like to point out that I was playing it very badly at that age. But I did play basketball for my kind of entire life. So I played, I started at the age of 8 and I played all the way through college. And so this book is very much personal to me in the same way that it became professional. So the big questions that drove me to want to research this topic and want to write this book in the first place are questions that I had been grappling with for many, many years, most seriously when I was playing college basketball. But I can sort of think back and see the beginnings of these questions even long before that.
And how much of your experience with college basketball kind of governs the way in which you write about it, given, say, every year with the NCAA basketball tournament? It seems like every year some social media thing comes out where some of the women's teams will post, hey, here's our weight room or here's our practice facility, and comparing it to what happens on the men's tournament. or on a more serious level, the what happened to the Utah women's team this year when they were in Idaho, I believe. But you have stories like this with the women's tournament. So how much of it is seen firsthand, not only the women's game, but potentially how that is, how the women's game is treated by the schools and the NCAA when compared to the men's game?
That's such a great point. I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind is the broader context of what's happening. You know, this book is a profile of a particular team at a particular time and place, but it's of course situated in this larger context that you're talking about. It's certainly been true, and there are sports scholars from a variety of fields who have talked about this for decades, that women's sports have been perceived to be lesser versions of men's sports. And the history of sport is really part of that story. So sports were created by and for men. And it took a lot of activism and effort to get women even playing sports. We've, of course, made a tremendous amount of progress. Women and girls are playing sports now more than ever. They are entering into sports that were previously only male dominated. They're even getting into other areas of sports outside of being players. So they're coaching, they're refereeing, they're, you know, managing teams, they're sportscasters, right? All of that. At the same time, we continue to see gender inequity when we look across. So to your point, I believe it was a couple of years ago that we saw some of the, in the NCAA tournament, we saw players posting, those images of sort of their like one room weight room with, you know, three or four dumbbells and that was supposed to, you know, serve training for the entire tournament. And then of course the men have these kind of fantastic training rooms and all sorts of things. And I think, you know, I think we've come a long way, but I think those are instances in which we are reminded that there is in fact still a lot of progress to be made. We are improving, but those are kind of nice reminders in some ways that there's always more work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've seen it too in this year with the PWHL, which has been very successful on the hockey side of things in the, I believe it's six markets, including here in Ottawa where I am. And they're filling the arenas they're in, filling NHL arenas when the folks who are playing in the NHL arenas too. So that's really great to see. Another question though that I wonder, and we don't have this in Canada, so I'm wondering if you could explain what, how it matters or if it does affect the perception of women's sports. That's Title IX, because you hear a lot about it and the need for the legal requirement for equity between men's and women's sports and spots. But how does that, if at all, potentially affect the perception of women's sports by audiences?
Well, I will say that the thing that I know to be true, and there's research that shows this, is that without Title IX, we would not have made as much progress as we have in the U.S. when it comes to women in sports. And so I think that is a tremendous piece of legislation that we need to continue to celebrate. You know, your question, though, about perception, I think is really interesting, because even with something like Title IX, we still continue to see pretty significant disparities, not just in the amounts of funding, for instance, that go to women's teams as opposed to men's teams at various colleges and universities, but also we continue to see this disparity in popularity. So in kind of the number of fans that turn out to games, and, you know, we could talk probably for a whole another hour about how that's changing, and particularly with teams like Iowa and players like Caitlin Clark, for example, certainly changing, and that's great. But that's the exception, unfortunately, to the rule. And that also applies, you know, at the professional level, which, of course, is not what the book is about. But I do draw on that that field as well. But yeah, we cannot underestimate the importance of that legislation. But again, it's not enough. I think we can be compliant with a law and still have a lot of inequity. And I think that's some of what I try to talk about in the book.
So let's get into the questions about identity. And one of the things that I was wondering in looking at the book and thinking about it was, there's a lot in here about personal identity and who individuals are when they come to their sports. But then there's also this whole thing about team identity. And my experience in sport wasn't so much that you aren't an individual when you're on a team, but the team comes first. So how do we kind of, just as a starting point, come to terms with personal identity versus team identity, where your coaches and administrators want to foster team identity and build this team dynamic, but also have to respect that, well, we hope they respect that each person has their own individual identity too. Like, how do we balance those two concepts when we're talking about building teams and participating in team sports?
That's such a great question. I mean, when I hear you talk about team identity, I think about, this is common, I think, across sports, which is that, yeah, the team comes first. There's no I in team, right? Anybody who's played sports would have that poster on their wall. Yeah. And so I think it's certainly true that there are, you know, that sort of supersedes everything else in some ways. I think when you start to look at athletics at the highest levels, you really do see the privileging of team over individual sort of identity, but also just kind of experience. And so for me, that's kind of this base layer. What I was interested in exploring with this book is personal identity, though, not so much like as athletes, but also how that identity is interplaying with these other more social identities. So things like gender, race, and sexuality. And interestingly, one of the things that surprised me when I was doing this research and that I end up talking quite a bit about is how not only do individuals sort of police themselves around those identities, but how that's also happening externally, sort of being imposed upon the players. So as much as the coaches, for example, in Denied wanted the team to be, you know, MWSU, the pseudonym that I use, the team, they also wanted a particular image of that team to be coming through. And so I talk a lot about that as well. So there is, I think everyone is doing this balancing that you're talking about between personal and group. And these things are happening internally and being externally imposed. So it is quite complex.
Yeah. So when you're talking about the intersectionality of all these things, of race, sexuality, gender, I would imagine to a certain extent, regional dynamics play into it as well, where you're from, where you grew up, the type of environment you're from. I at the highest level of the NCAA too, or just or really any sort of pseudo professional sport, because I'm going to call college sports pseudo professional at this point. Money plays into it. You know, the coaches and administrators are directly paid. The athletes, depending on the situation, may or may not be getting paid, or maybe not be getting funds in some capacity. So how do you as a researcher try to balance all of those things, right? This is one of the things that in the stuff that I've done, my own work, it tends to be pretty straightforward in terms of it's the history of big organizations, right? So it's, I deal with a lot of legislation and policy, that sort of stuff. It's easy. It's not so much dealing with people on the same level, right? So how do you balance all of those things when you're coming to a project like this and trying to understand the intersectionality?
Sean, first I want to say I appreciate that you think of your work as straightforward, because I hear you describe that and I'm like, wow, I'm glad I don't do that. Sounds very complex to me. But yeah, I think you bring up a really important question and a real challenge, I think particularly with qualitative research. You know, I had a specific set of research questions that I was looking to answer. And so I was, again, looking specifically at the identities of gender, sexuality, and race, but that's not to say that there's all kinds of other things going on that are influencing the situation. You mentioned region, which of course I think matters in some really, really important ways, especially as we think about the larger systems that are attached to these identities. So, you know, in the US, at least, we have very stark regional differences when it comes to things like acceptance of LGBTQ folks, for example. And to think that that's not going to impact individual players who may be in that region is I think, you know, very unlikely. The other reality is, and, you know, I don't talk as much about this, I sort of nod to it, is that social class, economic status plays a really important role. I don't mention this as much, but I would say 9 out of 10 players told me that had it not been for having a scholarship to go to MWSU and play basketball, they wouldn't be certainly at that school, and they may not be in college at all. So again, more dynamics than just the ones I'm looking at. But I think, as you know, as a researcher, you cannot, unfortunately, look at everything. So you do have to make these hard choices. And I think understand that there are probably other things happening all around this that you can address in some way, and then sort of the kind of common phrases outside the scope of this work, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And hope that some other researcher picks up the mantle, if you will.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get into some of the specifics of what you're talking about. And I'm curious about race, and in part because I just read the Kent Bapp story that Kim Mulkey was very angry about. Not the story about Kim Mulkey, as far as I know that hasn't come out yet, but the one about the football coach. And that one is very much about the idea of town and gown of sorts, where I believe that's a dynamic in a lot of towns, university towns in the United States, where campuses, rich campuses, can be primarily white and primarily black communities. And so that was sort of front of mind for me as I'm thinking about this. But in terms of your work and basketball is so associated with African-American culture, and most of the coaches are white, and there's all sorts of dynamics here. So how do you begin to look at race within the scope of this book and how it plays out in the team dynamic?
Yeah, I think what you bring up again is that, you know, race is operating at this sort of very high level, the structural level that is then trickling down to impact every other level. So the institution of sport itself, the school, each player, right, the dynamics that are happening. I would say for context, you know, what was really interesting for me about race in this broader sense is that NWSU was a school that was certainly elite athletically, but it was also academically elite. And so what you ended up having, like you described a little bit, is internal to the university, you had a mostly majority white, predominantly white student body with a very small percentage of black students. And many of those students were student athletes. And so there was this very clear racial dynamic happening. And many of the players talked to me about that, right? Is that they believe there was this perception that they didn't really deserve to be there and that they were there primarily because they were athletes. So they were certainly contending with that. What I was really curious about, though, is how race was operating as interplaying with gender and interplaying with sexuality to shape their everyday experiences. And I'll be a little bit more concrete. So I was really curious about this idea of the cultural contradiction of women's athleticism, which is a, of course, you know, $100 academic phrase. But, you know, I think if I were to break it down, it's just simply that because the institution of sports was created for men, when women are playing sports, the idea is that they will have to engage in behaviors that we think of as masculine behaviors. And as a result, they're going to feel some tension between their gender and their athletic identities. And they will try to do things to mediate that tension. But most of the research, and this research began, you know, in the 1970s, even a little bit earlier than that, was looking only at white athletes. And most of the scholars were rightly saying this probably differs by race, but we don't exactly know how. And so I wanted to explore that. We know that how we think about gender, at least in the US, is deeply connected to how we think about race. And that dates back to kind of our history of race in the United States. The way in which we come to understand what femininity is and what masculinity is deeply, deeply racialized. And so I was really trying to explore what that meant for the players. And it turns out that it mattered in some pretty significant ways that I end up talking about.
Yeah. Is that in turn, like, how does that manifest? Is it the messages that young black girls are being told compared to young white girls, compared to young Hispanic girls that they're getting externally? Is there sort of family dynamics, internal community dynamic? Like where does that, what is the genesis or some of the genesis of those differences?
Genocide? I don't know what you said. Yeah. You know, I think it's all of the above, if I'm being honest. So these messages are certainly happening at the societal level. You know, we're absorbing them always, all the time. I would say when it comes to this context, those messages are coming both, you know, they're internally happening. They're also playing out at the interpersonal level between players. They're playing out, like you said, family, friends, acquaintances, and then, yeah, coaches, administrators. So, you know, a more concrete example, you know, what I ended up finding is that the athletes who were Black, who expressed gender in more non-normative ways, and who were queer experienced the most kinds of policing of their identities as compared to other athletes who didn't have that same constellation of identities. And I argue that that's because of, again, if the attempt is to create an image of players and an image of the team as, you know, appropriately feminine or appropriately heterosexual, whatever it might be, race really complicates that picture because we have different understandings of, you know, our standards of beauty really were built upon notions of whiteness and white women. So you're sort of inherently excluding Black women from that definition. And so there's all kinds of, you know, complex ways in which I saw that play out for this team.
In terms of the policing of identities, how much, if at all, does age matter into that? Because not only do you have all these other dynamics in a college basketball team, they're young women who are participating in the sport. And obviously all the administrators and the coaches are older. And like, is there an age element to it, just given the demographic that make up college teams?
Sure, of course. I mean, again, I think, you know, definitely where I think that probably manifests most significantly is in the power dynamics between coaches and players. So certainly it's that you have, you know, you have athletes who are, some of them are 17, 18, right? Just coming out of high school. At most, if they're traditional age, which all of these players were, you know, they're 21, 22 years old, right? Their brains aren't even fully developed. They're young people. And then you have coaches, right, who are much older. But I think age in conjunction with a kind of deference that happens with coaches. I mean, coaches hold a tremendous amount of power in sports. And I think we see the negative ramifications of that a lot in the media when we hear about, you know, stories of abuse, or certainly Bobby Knight, I think, is a kind of quintessential example of, you know, coaching styles that really manipulate and take advantage of that power. But I think that's where the combination of age plus status as a result of the position really does certainly matter. I mean, the players, even when they would tell me separately that they didn't think that what the coaches were asking them was fair, or they felt some kind of way about it, they were not saying that to the coaches.
Right. Is there a difference or an effect of the gender of the coach? Especially in women's sports, there are a lot of men's coaches. Don't see as many women coaches in men's sports. So the dynamic of that really does exist in women's sports. In the players you talk to, in your experience, does it matter if the coach is a man or a woman with respect to some of these policing things that you're talking about?
It's possible. You know, that's a separate study, frankly. That's really an empirical question. Yeah. You know, I will say, if I were to just kind of speculate, I think, you know, it's interesting in the case of MWSU, the team I was with, the head coach was a woman. Much of the coaching staff were also women. And there were a couple of men at sort of lower levels of the coaching staff. And so I do wonder, you know, it's curious to me about how that dynamic played out. You know, in some ways I can speculate that in fact it allowed for a greater level of policing because there wasn't as much, you know, I think sometimes with male coaches and men coaches and women athletes, there's these sort of boundaries that get put up in certain ways that are, you know, not socially acceptable to cross. Whereas I think with same gender pairings, maybe those boundaries don't exist. And so there's some possibility for different dynamics. But again, you know, unfortunately, I wish I could know, right? Do it all again with a different coaching staff and see. But yeah.
So there was a story recently, the incoming U.S. women's soccer manager who is coaching in the UK right now. There was a story about her. She said something along the lines of relationships within a team are bad. And this was in the context of two of her players on that team in the UK were in a relationship. And so there was a lot of blowback to that idea. Is that an example of the policing of identities that you're identifying in the book? And is, because one of the things that does come up is policing or governing who the players date and who they're socializing with. So is that the sort of thing that would be part of this policing that you're identifying?
Definitely. I think, and the reality is that athletes are policed in all kinds of ways all the time, based on identity and otherwise, right? So identity aside, it's certainly the case in college that players, when they wake up, what they eat, when they go to class, how they train, who they're allowed to socialize with, whether they're allowed to use cell phones or have social media, all these things are policed by coaches. Now it's not that they don't get around those things. The players in my book, they all had backup cell phones. So there's certainly ways around it, but sure. I mean, I think the example you just gave is an example of policing of the athletes. And, I could certainly see arguments about why that would be important. Team dynamics. So this goes back to our first, the first question is team dynamics sort of take precedence above everything else, right? If you have a relationship go sour, that can impact your team dynamics. So yeah. Coaches are likely thinking about that. So there are ways in which I think rules that people might have, ways they're policing or trying to restrict and constrain athletes are, with this sort of well intention. And there are other ways where, at least in the kinds of policing I'm talking about, it's actually not about performance at all, right? It's about perception. But I can see why people would push back on that as well.
Yeah. Well, in terms of perception, one of the things that is really interesting about the way in which writers write about women's sport is if John McEnroe yells at a chair umpire, he's fiery and intense. When Serena Williams does it, she's having a meltdown and is totally unhinged. And is that sort of discussion point on how men's and women's athletes are written about differently in terms of the intensity that they show during a game, is that sort of thing internalized consciously? Like do the women who you're talking to, when they're on the court, when they're playing, if they're frustrated with an official, do they recognize that the way they're perceived could be different for that official, especially if it's an official who say does men's games, women's games, or announcers or whoever else? Like, is that something that they're conscious of in the moment, or is it off court where it really becomes an issue and something that weighs on them?
It's hard to say for sure. I would imagine that for some of them, it is very conscious. And I think, again, the more sort of marginalized identities that you hold, the more likely my guess is that those things are conscious. So the Black athletes that I talk to in the book, are very aware that perceptions of them are being mediated by stereotypes about Black people in general, but about Black athletes more specifically, that, how they show up on the court is going to be judged in various ways based on their gender presentation, based on what people are assuming their sexuality is, for example. So certainly I can imagine, right? And I think the stereotype that comes to my mind most easily when you're talking especially about Serena is the kind of angry Black woman stereotype, right? That any sort of expression of emotion, this is true for women generally, right? Women's expressions of emotion, particularly if they're negative, tend to be perceived as in much different ways than, of course, men's expressions of those same emotions. But I think then when you add race to that, it's certainly the case that when Black players may be arguing with a ref, for example, that's going to be perceived differently than white players. There is this sort of perception that it's more aggressive inherently or more potentially violent. And we see we see this in also more mundane ways. If you remember last NCAA women's basketball tournament when LSU played Iowa, there was a moment in which Angel Reese from LSU did a hand gesture. Yes. That Iowa's Caitlin Clark had been doing the entire tournament. And the public reaction to that same gesture. So even this isn't even about men and women, right? It is ultimately, but it's also right between women based on, again, the different kind of identities that we hold and how that matters.
Yeah. There was also a situation, I think it was the SEC tournament this year, South Carolina, and I can't remember who they were playing.
LSU.
And yeah. LSU. And there was the incident there that got in listening to everything afterwards, that was dealt with differently than a similar scuffle would have been in a men's game for sure.
100%, right? And it goes back to this notion that like men, we sort of expect, right, boys will be boys, men will fight. But when women do it, we're shocked, right? We can't believe that something like this would happen. So yeah.
In terms of sort of that presentation on the court too, in the women you're talking to, and just in general in your research, how does that affect, if at all, the way they dress or the elements of dress that you can control when you're playing a team sport? Because obviously the jersey and shorts, right, that's given to you by the school, but hair, earrings, if they're allowed, depending on the sport. I don't know what the rules are in basketball in terms of jewelry, but like those sorts of things are even potentially nail polish or tattoos, any whatever it is, right? The things that are visible to the crowd and to a television audience. Again, consciously, are they thinking about these things and how they are going to be policed and governed?
So this was one of the main questions of my research is are there ways in which women athletes are overemphasizing their femininity in order to counter any perceptions of them as masculine or the connection to sexuality as lesbians, which is, you know, a big part of the book that I talk about. And the answer is yes, they do all kinds of things. Now, they're not, most of the time, I would say these are not conscious things they're doing. These are very deeply ingrained gendered behaviors that if you were to ask them, which I did, do you do anything special in order to appear feminine? They would say, no, I don't do anything that I don't normally do otherwise. When you probe a little bit and you start to dig a little deeper, you see that that's not always the case. So certainly I would say some of the big things we see the athletes, and you mentioned uniforms. Sure, everybody gets the same jersey and shorts, but you can roll those shorts up as high as you want, right? You could do sort of even things with that. But certainly I would say nail polish, making sure their legs were shaved, their armpits are shaved, wearing makeup. Jewelry isn't allowed, but certainly there are other ways to embellish, certainly hairstyles, right? Making sure your hair is done in a particular kind of way or looking, you know, quote unquote, presentable in some ways. You know, those are all strategies that many of the women engaged. Some of them did things like trying to cover tattoos with like wristbands or, you know, socks and that sort of thing. Not all of them did. But I think importantly, and this was one of the big points I tried to make in the book, is so this is happening when individual players are making these decisions. I would argue, you know, there's a context in which these decisions are being made. So it's not that simple. But these were also expectations that were being placed upon them by their coaches. And I tell a story in the book of one of the star players of MWSU, who I call Rowan. And, you know, Rowan was one of the best players ever to come through the program. She ended up having a long career in the WNBA. So she is coming down onto the court for pregame warmup. And she's coming down sort of stadium steps, and she's running down, and I'm standing with the coaches, and the head coach sees her coming down, and, you know, her hair is a little bit loose, you know, she's running. So, you know, hair is kind of wisping out of the ponytail. And the coach, you know, sort of said, like, I can't believe she would come down looking like that. And so she gets to the court, and one of the assistant coaches walks up to her. And then you see her sort of, I watched her run off the court. She comes back, you know, 5 or 10 minutes later, and her hair is, you know, slicked back, not a strand out of place, right? So what I try to argue is like, look, she might not have been thinking at all about her hair until that moment. And then you better believe she certainly was, right?
Right.
And my whole point is like, it's not that there's anything wrong with making sure your hair looks nice, right? If that makes you feel good, do it. What's wrong with it from my perspective is that right before you're about to play a game, you shouldn't have to be thinking about that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And that it's an external pressure too, and that it's coming from the coach and someone in a position of authority to govern it. Yeah. For sure. Within that scope too, I'm curious about the idea of, as it relates to gender and sexuality, is there examples or are the women policed? Because you mentioned they're policed more, the more points of marginalization is that also happening for them internally? Like, are queer women trying to present as non-queer or more queer or like whatever, like leaning, like how do they govern it themselves, recognizing that they're operating within this context? how do they respond to it? And certainly you have examples, I'm sure, just generally of some people who try to sort of get away from it and be conform, and other people who really lean into where the points of marginalization. So how do you actually try to understand that in doing this research?
This is one of those areas that I think is most tricky, because this is where you see really the kind of battle between individual agency and sort of larger structure of constraint within a team. So the example that comes to mind for me when you ask this question is, you know, recruiting is one of the most important aspects of collegiate basketball. And so when recruits were coming to MWSU, the coaches had very clear rules for the players. And those rules, by and large, were around sexuality and gender presentation as it connects to sexuality. So, for example, they would say, when a recruit is here, no baggy shorts, no baseball caps, no, you know, Converse, no, and then beyond, you know, clothes, they would say, no talking about your girlfriends, no, don't take players to, you know, certain areas that were perceived to be queer. And so there were all these ways in which, again, even if the players didn't want to comply, they needed to. Now, they pushed back in their own little ways, for sure. But they were able to do this, I think, kind of delicate dance of saying, look, I might feel completely comfortable with who I am as a queer athlete, and I understand that this is the game I have to play. Right. I think what was kind of most interesting to me is then when players get there, you know, the assumption, of course, is that we do all this because the players, we presume, are straight and want to be in an environment in which they're around people who are just like them, which, of course, is not true. Right. And many of the players then come in and they not only realize that, in fact, many of these players are queer, but they themselves are queer. And they're like, why did y'all do this? What was the point of that? And they're like, we don't know. We had to. So there's this disconnect, right, also between perceptions of what people, what kind of environments people want, and the reality of that. And I think that's changing, but I think it's slow to change.
Well, in terms of that, the recruiting side, I'm interested by the recruiting side. And how much of a recruiting process, obviously when they come to campus, they would be around players, but how much of the process and what is presented is by the structure set up by the athletic director and then the coach and then the assistant coaches who are going around, who many of whom may not be part of those communities, right? If it's sort of white, straight male, who's the head coach, might not have the familiarity with that community. So how much of that governs the recruiting process in its entirety, both when coaches are going around the country, going to high schools, visiting people, but also when recruits come to campus?
Yeah, it's hard to say for sure. I'm sure it works a little bit differently, you know, depending on the program. I would say at MWSU, you know, the team really had a lot of control over it. So the coaching staff in particular, a lot of control over what those visits looked like, at least the campus visits. And you have to remember that a lot of these players, if not most of them, are coming with their parents too, at least one parent or some sort of family member. And so a lot of this work that was happening was actually for the families,
right,
not so much for the players themselves. So I think that's important to note. But yeah, it's certainly true that the coaches do, you know, they're the sort of main point of connection to these recruits, but the recruits spend a ton of time with the athletes, right? They're likely staying in the dorms with the athletes. They're eating meals together. They're sort of being toured around with athletes. Certain athletes, right, who are chosen specifically to sort of represent the team. So I think that's one of the most sort of interesting facets, is who gets to be the face of the team.
Right.
And who doesn't? That, you know, is you know, certainly interesting to me.
Right. So it's not just sort of the juniors and seniors who are selected. It's or the quote unquote best player. It's there's
not in my experience, not in my experience as an athlete, and not in my experience with this team as well. It's certainly a much more curated experience, again, to provide to sort of. Based on assumptions or based on real knowledge of the recruits and their sort of likes and dislikes, the attempt then is to curate an experience that's going to, you know, wow them in all the ways that we would expect. And, you know, I mentioned Rowan, the athlete. So I talk about her in relation to this as well, because she told me a story about how when she was being recruited by this team, she said to the coach, she said, you know, I heard that a lot of the players are queer, and I don't want to be around queer players. And the coach did all kinds of work to reassure her that it's going to be okay. Nobody's going to try to turn you. We're going to make sure everything is fine, and all this sort of work around that. Many years later, you know, Rowan herself ends up identifying as queer, but that's a sort of side side story. But it's interesting, right? Because there's all of these dynamics at play at the same time.
And is there anything to the that is specific to college, in that college sports, by their very nature of being at a college or university, are somewhat transient, and the longest a player is going to be there is 5 years, with some exceptions, but generally speaking, 5 years is your max. And then players move on, but coaches, especially successful ones, will stay for decades and decades. But like, how much of that kind of plays into it? Just the constant churn of players, I guess, just based on just the reality of it being a college team.
Yeah, I think that matters. And I think at the same time, there's a way in which a culture can develop within a team context that can sort of become so deeply rooted that players will adapt very quickly to that culture. And that even as sort of this revolving door of players come and go, that piece remains. And I'll give you an example of with this team. So when I talked about, you know, do you do anything before games to make sure you look a kind of way? The athletes were telling me, you know, when we came in as freshmen, we were like, this is nuts. These older juniors and seniors are telling us, no, you have to make sure, no, your hair looks a mess. You got to fix that. You can't go out like that. And we were like, that's nuts. And then they're like, here we are 3 years later doing the same thing to the freshmen. Right. So again, this way that, and certainly coaches shape the culture, right? Expectations, and then the players themselves. And I think that tends, right? Players can be swapped in and out, and that tends to stay the same.
The book predates a lot of what currently is going on in the NCAA, because there's been a whole sea change with the NCAA. And right now, I don't actually know, because Caitlin Clark hasn't said, but there's a perception that Caitlin Clark is probably making more money now than she will when she graduates and goes to the WNBA. Although if I saw that Ice Cube offered her $5 million to play in his league, so maybe she'll go do that. I don't know. But on the assumption that she goes to the WNBA, there would probably be a bit of a pay cut for her, potentially, depending on ads and all that. So how much does sort of this idea of money, and that has, in your opinion, I know it's not within the scope of the book, but has the changing face of college athletics as it relates to money, and therefore with name, image, and likeness, potentially, do athletes have more agency in terms of the individual identity and identities that they have? Do you think that potentially could change some of the issues that and the intersectionality that you're talking about in this book? Like, does that element of it have any influence?
Oh, absolutely. I always tell people, if I were to write a book right now, I'd be writing on name, image, and likeness, because I think that's really, we see some profound changes happening when it comes to the access of women athletes, not just to financial resources, but to the public, right, in these ways. I mean, I think that's been a big factor in the popularity, the surge in popularity of collegiate sports and also professional sports for women. But, you know, I think something when you ask about the identity piece, you know, there was a great New York Times article a few years ago now about name, image, and likeness. And, you know, wouldn't you know that the players, who the women athletes who are making the most money off of those kinds of endorsements, are the ones who are presenting your most kind of traditional forms of femininity, right? So they're athletes, but they're also, you know, they conform to these really specific standards of beauty. They're not your, you know, with some exceptions, they're not your necessarily your queer athletes, your gender nonconforming athletes. They're, you know, your pretty white athletes who are, you know, making, I think, the most money, again, with exceptions. So I think, again, these dynamics have a way of seeping into, right? Even when we see progress, I think we still have to pay attention to what that means, again, based on other aspects of identity.
Yeah, and you certainly saw it with Brittany Griner and her situation in Russia, and you know, obviously we don't have to get into the specifics of the Russian legal system such as it exists, but the way in which it was perceived back home, particularly by a certain section of the media, was, well, it's her fault. And you see it with like children who are abducted, right? There's, you know, when it's a little white girl who's abducted, it gets all sorts of attention, right? And certainly in Canada, we have the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, like, and just sort of these questions that continually come up. And, you know, one of the things that I'm curious about is, within that realm, how much does sport offer, if at all, in your assessment and in your discussions with fellow athletes, how much does sports offer that platform for change? A lot was made in 2020 with the bubble, when the WNBA players really were the ones who were leading the push with the Black Lives Matter and other social movements. How much is, or how important is it for athletes to use that platform, or is the platform for women athletes that they have, does that present them the opportunity to push against a lot of what you're writing about in this book? And does that give them more agency than perhaps some of the other students at a college who aren't on the basketball team or other athletes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, with some exceptions, I think still to be a student athlete is to assume a level of status at a university that brings you certainly a visibility with which you can use that platform to do all kinds of things, good, bad, otherwise. And, you know, when it comes to activism, I mean, we see athletes really leading the charge in a lot of ways. I write in the book towards the end that, you know, long before Colin Kaepernick took a knee and sort of became the face of the activism around racial justice, you had WNBA players doing similar sorts of protesting before games. And so I think that really does matter. I mean, I think, you know, you could have a separate discussion about, you know, whether athletes should be activists, right? But assuming, you know, setting that aside, I mean, certainly, I think there's a way in which we see athletes doing that. And I think social media, certainly the ability to sort of make yourself visible to the world in these kind of new ways, certainly is an important factor in that way. And not just around activism, but I would say to your point around identity, we're certainly seeing an embrace, and I'll use the WNBA again as an example. You know, when the WNBA was first, the early days of the league, they were doing things like having makeup classes for rookies, right? To come through and say, oh, let's make sure you, right? And they were sort of really, I think, leaning into this, let's create this sort of quote unquote family image, right? They've really abandoned that now. And they're sort of saying, look, let's embrace who our players actually are, who our fan base actually is, and let's really lean into that. And you see some really awesome things coming of that. So much more diversity, so much more engagement from, you know, audiences that you know, were previously, I think, not thought of as being worth investing in. And so I think that's a really positive change too.
Yeah. And I think in a time, certainly from an external perspective, where the United States could use things that bring everyone together. And I think the same is true in Canada a little bit as well. But if the players are given the opportunity to be themselves, be authentically themselves, then if you bring in fans, like if you're cheering for somebody who, like, if for whatever, like you're have this perception of political persuasion, whatever it is, and you're cheering for somebody who has the opposite one, then that's okay. Like that brings us together in a way, right? And we can at least acknowledge that we're all human beings and deserve respect. Like it seems like a natural way to bring everyone together, because at the end of the day, when you're cheering for a team or playing on a team, you just want to score more points than the other side. Yep. Like that's kind of it, right? And we can all rally around that. And it can be a platform or a space where we can engage with folks who aren't necessarily like us.
I think that's so right. And, you know, I think that's true for, like you said, for players, right? So when I went to college, my teammates exposed me to cultures and identities that I had not experienced before, because I grew up in a bubble. And so just that possibility, right? Being able to have that common interest, you know, sort of an embracing our difference and really forming bonds and becoming close. I think that's really incredible. And like you said, for the fan base, right? The sports would give us this brief moment, right, to set aside all of the other, you know, political, ideological, you know, religious, whatever it is, differences that are really tearing us apart. And yeah, like, let's just cheer for the same team, right? So yeah, I think the more that sports leagues can embrace that, I think the better. I think athletes can really lead the charge in that way. And I think something you said earlier, it's always going to be better if we can create spaces in which people feel like they can show up as themselves, right? In their full, authentic self with all of their identities. Not only is it going to make the space, I think, more just enjoyable for people, but I would guess that players are also going to play better. Again, that's an empirical question, but I would bet money on it.
Yeah, if you can just show up and play the game and don't have to worry about anything else, you would expect that they would play better, or at the very least would be the scouting process would be like on the pregame meetings and stuff. You'd be more in tune with it because you're not thinking about these other things. You're only focusing on the beating the other side. And that really is what it should be, right? Like you want to just beat the other team. That's, you know, and then shake hands at the end of the game and move on, right? It's not
live to play another day.
Exactly. Yeah. So we should say too, like, obviously the book is about basketball, but as we were talking about before we started to record, these issues go beyond basketball. It exists in women's sports across the board. And certainly I talk a lot about women's curling and the difference between men's and women's curling, the way it's perceived. Mentioned the Professional Women's Hockey League, which has been a great success so far in its first season, but there are issues in the way that women's hockey has been perceived over the years. And so it really just exists across the board. So for you as an author and a researcher, what would your kind of pitch be for folks who might say, well, I don't really follow basketball, or I'm here in Canada, I don't really care about the NCAA. Like what is the pitch for kind of the universal impact of the issues that you're talking about in the book?
I love this question because I sort of jokingly, but really not, say to people, despite the title and despite the cover photo, this really is not a book about sports. Yeah. So even if you don't like sports, my hope is, you know, and what I tried to do in this book is I tried to say, how can we look at the institution of sport to understand these larger things that are going on at the societal level that impact us, our everyday lived experience? And I think you can take a lot of these themes and you could pull them out of, certainly out of basketball, like you're saying, you could attach them to other sports. You could pull them out of sports altogether and see these things happening all around us. Women in business, right? Women in, you know, all kinds of male dominated fields. There's great research on women, police, firefighters, right? All these ways in which you see different institutions playing out in the same sorts of ways. So my pitch would be, you know, give it a try. Yeah. And my sense is that folks, if you can get past the sports stuff, you can see that, there's a lot in this book that helps us, I think, make sense of these bigger issues around race, gender, sexuality that, are certainly within the sport context here, but I think matter in all kinds of ways outside of it.
Yeah, another one, politics too. I think the way white women are perceived in politics, and there's a election or series of elections. I don't really fully understand the number of elections you guys have down there. It seems like there's a lot of them, but election year in the United States, we are likely, well, we have to have an election by the fall of 2025, federal election in Canada. It might be earlier. We'll see what happens, but certainly it matters in politics as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So again, the book is Denied: Women, Sports, and the Contradictions of Identity. Michelle, if people want to get a copy of the book, what is the best way for them to do that?
You can get a copy directly from NYU Press. You can also, you know, I'm a big fan of your local bookstore. If they don't have it on their shelves, ask them to order it. And then, of course, you know, all kinds of online options as well.
Yes. And I was very pleased to see that for NYU, at least with this book, paperback and the hardcover came out at the same time, which it always bothers me when university presses do the hardcover first and wait 6 months for the paperback.
Oh, yeah. No, buy the paperback. It's cheaper, and you actually get the cover photo. The hardback is the library version, so don't bother with that.
All right. And Michelle, if people want to keep up with everything you got going on across your other research, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, you know, I love a good email, michelle.mano@northwestern.edu. That's my day job. I work in diversity at Northwestern University. I am on Twitter, but very rarely. So send me an email or find me on LinkedIn. That's the best way. Love to chat.
All right. And we will link to the book down below in the show notes. So be sure to check it out again. So Michelle, again, it's Denied: Women's Sports and the Contradictions of Identity. Michelle J. Mano, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sean.
So there you have it, my discussion with Michelle J. Mano, and I thank her for her time. Again, the book is Denied: Women, Sports, and the Contradictions of Identity. So with that, let's get right into today's historical headline of the week. And you might have seen this one. It was an exclusive CBC story that spread pretty broadly, and I'm going with an opinion piece by Shireen Ahmed on the CBC about the WNBA's Toronto expansion. The article is, WNBA's Toronto expansion will help amplify culture of women's basketball in Canada. This is her assessment of the significance of the expansion of the WNBA, which, as I record this, has not been made official by the league as yet. But the CBC report has been verified by other outlets. Nobody has countered that. So short of the official announcement from the league, we're going to go with this and say that the reporting is correct. So the WNBA will be expanding to Toronto in a couple years, along with a team in the Bay Area, which I believe was just announced that there will be the Valkyries out in the Bay Area, yet unnamed in Toronto. But it does lead to a lot of discussion about what does this mean. The team, I think it's interesting that the team is not going to be part of Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. Larry Tannenbaum, who is a part owner of Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, is doing this with another group that he has, but it's not Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. So from a business perspective, that is a little curious. How will the women's basketball team relate to the other major teams in Toronto, all of which are owned by Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, with the exception of the Toronto Blue Jays? So there's some questions there. But more importantly, as it relates to what we were talking about with Michelle, how does the league's presence in Canada influence some of the other broader issues that are at play with women's sports? We don't have in this country the same culture of intercollegiate athletics. They exist, and the athletes in those sports are very talented, highly competitive. I had a couple years where I was at the University of Regina when I was doing my master's degree, working at some of the games, and you just saw how hard those athletes work. But we don't have that same culture. It's not big business in Canada as it is in the United States. And I do wonder how that influences the professional game in this country, and not just with women's basketball, but really across the board. And so as it relates to some of the issues that Michelle was talking about, the policing of identities and expression, does being in Canada change that at all? Does it influence the way that players express themselves? I don't know. And all American athletes who come to Canada, with some exceptions, talk about how they like it, particularly in Toronto. People who come and play for the Raptors really do enjoy it. Will the same situation exists on the women's side? Certainly we would hope so. And while a lot of the issues that Michelle is talking about are specific to college basketball, as we talked about at the end, they are transferable to women's sport writ large. So as we talk about the WNBA coming to Toronto, as Shireen Ahmed talks about in her article for the CBC, this will amplify the culture of women's basketball in Canada, and we'll see how some of the contradictions of identity play out in a Canadian market for the WNBA. So again, today's historical headline of the week: WNBA's Toronto expansion will help amplify culture of women's basketball in Canada, by Shireen Ahmed on the CBC, May 15th, 2024. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get the podcast, like, rate, comment. All that other good stuff helps keep the show growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. Great written material over there on the website. All of our past episodes are available under the podcast tab. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's old is news at gmail.com. So thanks again so much for listening. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old is News.